Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. When things go sideways, will you be prepared? Some people are concerned they might have to go for a long time without electricity or even food. That's why I want to introduce you to 4patriots.com. Get preparedness products you can use now, and that could save your life later. My favorite is 4patriots' new solar generator, the Patriot Power Generator 2000X. It uses the endless free power of the sun to power lights, your TV, medical equipment, even run your fridge. Plus, it's expandable and comes with a free solar panel. Or pick up one of 4patriots' best-selling survival food kits. Delicious tasting and designed to last for 25 years. They even have kits with real meat, and if the power's out, no worries. Just boil water over a fire, simmer, and serve. You'll enjoy a hot meal and stay safe in a crisis. More smart people than ever are finding 4patriots. Over 2 million customers trust them, and you might have even seen them on TV. I had the folks at 4patriots set up a special page for you at 4patriots.com/drive-on so that listeners of this podcast can see this week's discounts and deals before they go away. Go to 4patriots.com/drive-on, but hurry, these deals won't last long. Save more and get peace of mind now by going to 4patriots.com/drive-on. From a small Pennsylvania Bible college to the jungles of Korea and the burn pits of Iraq, my next guest, Jeff Circle, is a veteran, author, and award-winning journalist. His journey from serving in the Army to living in the U.S. Virgin Islands and beyond is a roller coaster of experiences, and today he's going to join us to discuss his mission of getting more veterans into writing. So before we get into that, but I want to welcome you to the show, Jeff. Really glad to have you here.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be on.
Yeah, you bet. So let's take it back a bit, and I kind of want to talk about your journey and how you got to where you are right now. So you initially joined the Army Reserves, and then later transitioned into active duty. I know a lot of people who've done the opposite. They started off active duty, and then, you know, as time went on, they decided, I'm getting too old for this shit kind of thing. And they decided, I could still do it maybe part-time. But, tell me about your time in getting into the Army and what prompted the change to go active duty.
Well, like you said, I was going to Bible college in Pennsylvania and needed some extra money. And it was mostly for pizza. But someone said, hey, this might be a cool thing. And then I saw Top Gun, kid you not, and I was in. And I went to the recruiting station, went to the Navy first, like a little jackass, and I want to do that. And the guy looked at me and said, no way, kid, get out of here. Yeah. And so I went to the Army, and the Army dude was, oh, yeah, you want to do something? Oh, Army Reserve, yeah, we've got something for you. Because, I can't be a pilot as a reservist. I'm like 22 or something. And so... joined the Army, got into my reserve unit a couple months, and then they shipped me off to basic training in Fort Dix, New Jersey in April. So I was there April, May, June, July, terrible. And then when I picked a job, my recruiter was slick. And all you recruiters out there, listen up. You got a thing. You've got a list of jobs, and they're all like, oh, you can be a truck driver, or you can be a mechanic, or you can, you can join the infantry, or all these other things. And then he picks up a clipboard and says, oh, intelligence analyst. I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what they do. I was like, I want that. So I went off to Fort Huachuca in July, August, September. So the bottom of Arizona in the summer. It was fantastic.
Oh, my God. And that's awful.
Believe it or not, yeah, it was awful. And when I got back, I said, I want to go back and do that again. I want more of that. So it was the dumbest thing in the world. Basic training and AIT in the Army made me want full time. And my unit said, hey, we just paid for all this training, so you've got to stay here for 6 months. Ended up going active duty as soon as they let me. I said, what's the first date available? And they said April 4th. And I was on the bus April 4th. So that's how I went. Dumbest thing. But it was the greatest thing.
Yeah. It's kind of like almost like that unknown situation where you go into it and even the recruiter didn't know what the hell, you're getting into, and you go into it not really knowing what it's all about.
I had no plan. Yeah. All I knew is I wanted to be a Top Gun pilot. And they said, yeah, forget that. Right. And when he said Intel analyst, and then I kid you not, Scott, this is his exact words. I don't know what they do. That's some James Bond shit.
Oh, nice. Like, oh, that's a secret sauce right there. Like, that's
going to get I'm in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You went from Top Gun to James Bond. And I don't know. I mean, both of them are pretty cool, you know? So I don't know that it's like you got second best in that, you know what I mean? So I
listen to Jack Stewart. I see him on interviews, and I've met him a few times. He's a super guy, and his stories are great, and my stories aren't as fun.
Well, it's starting off that way. It's starting off pretty fun.
There I was sitting in the field.
Yeah, no shit. There I was. Yeah. So you make the switch to active duty, and you served during the Gulf War time period.
Did.
What was that experience like? Anything notable there that you care to share?
You know, so many things, Scott, in life are better when you look back on them.
Sure.
So, you know, active duty, I signed up. I decided, well, let's do something weird. I don't want to go to Fort Bliss or Fort Polk. So I went to Korea for my first year, and that was eye-opening. And I loved it, and I wanted more. Ended up PCSing like normal. You get to do your year and go back to the States. Ended up at Fort Hood. And within a year, Iraq invaded Kuwait. And they said, you're going. I'm like, what? And I was in an armor unit. I was in General Patton's 2nd Division, Hell on Wheels Armor Division. And we were in the 1st Tiger Brigade, and they didn't send the whole division. They just sent the Tiger Brigade. And so there it was. He's sitting in Saudi Arabia, digging foxholes. And that was amazing. And so I'm digging foxholes and working out of a tactical operations center, which is 4 armored vehicles. They back up together and roll out tents, and you're walking on plywood floors and hope that you don't get, you know, stung by scorpions and all this stuff. And every night I was the NCO in charge at night. So I worked from midnight to noon, and I'd look up. There were the pilots. Because if you remember, if you know your history at this point, because I'm old, you got to consider it history. They just bombed the hell out of Iraq for months before, you know, they said, okay, Tiger Brigade, go. Right. So there I was looking up at my Top Gun pilots.
Digging all the guys, all the guys that you wanted to be, and then you're digging the foxhole. So maybe you did get second best in that
deal. Where's my tuxedo and my martini? Where's the James Bond?
Yeah, James Bond did not have an e-tool digging a shovel or digging a foxhole, you know.
No. So, yeah, we rolled, and it was amazing. I finally embraced it, because at first we were prepping back at Fort Hood with all the intel guys, and they're like, Iraq is a serious army. They've been at war. They're experienced. They're battle-hardened. They've been at it with Iran for 8 years. These guys are used to it. And we're like, yeah, we sit in a skiff, you know. So we at first were a little concerned, but then after we kind of broke it all down and Schwarzkopf, you know, kind of put together a super plan, it was, yeah, let's roll. And so, you know, we ended up going over the border, and that was a fun 72, 96 hours. We cleared some foxholes because as we found out, they were guys on the other side digging foxholes too, but their foxholes were so much cooler than ours. There's like little caves. They had so long to build these. We went down into this complex. And I remember this one foxhole we went into, this guy, you know, this is Iraqi, got called up probably at the last minute and said, you're going to the front line, son. And walked in, you know, we're clearing it all out, and he had a shelf built into the foxhole, and there was a little sterno thing going. I mean, he had a tea. It was still hot. there were some books, and there was a small book. It was a calendar, every year a calendar. And I'm flipping through this thing because we're looking for any kind of intel we can get to at that point. And I remember there was a picture of 4 people, two men, two women. The men were military aged, and I could see in the background there was a sign that said Bank of Saudi Arabia in the back. And I just thought about those people. I'm like, you know what? They got called up. They're probably on vacation, and they took this with them to war. And, you know, what happened happened, but they were people too. And I walked away from that with actually a really good experience. It's served me well since I've left.
You know, and that's an interesting perspective to have too, because a lot of times when we go to war, and this is generations back, this is not just a, you know, a more recent phenomenon, we tend to dehumanize the enemy that we're fighting against, right? We come up with derogatory names for them, and we think of them as less than human maybe, but really they're, you know, they're soldiers just like we were. They had families, they had, you know, hopes and dreams that didn't include, you know, a rifle and, you know, all of that other stuff, right? They had all of that just like we do. And so we kind of forget about some of that stuff, but on the intel side, I got to imagine you see the more human side of things, a little bit more than maybe the infantry guys who are like I was, who just are looking at, you know, this little silhouette on at the end of your rifle, you know?
Right. Yeah. And the humanity of it really hit home even more to where I can still visualize it today.
Yeah.
And it's a long time of the Mutla Ridge. It's this gap in between Kuwait City, the only main road out. And, you know, the A-10, you know, Warthog pilots and all those Top Gun guys, you know, they blew that place to hell. And we were tasked to go through that afterwards and, you know, find survivors, or, you know, there was the, you know, dead body detail. And that just really, you know, kid from Pennsylvania or from Ohio, but, you know, kid from college, and then all of a sudden thrown into that, saw, you know, things that stick with you. One of the things that I remember the most was how the materials that we were going through were Kuwaiti property. Civilian cars loaded down with stuff that all these soldiers stole. Mm. And they took over when they went to Kuwait City. And I mean, household goods in personally owned vehicles that belonged to people in Kuwait, civilians, and all these Iraqi soldiers were trying to take it all out. Yeah. And, you know, they got bombed at the beginning, at the top of the gap. And so everything else was a pot shot. That humanity has stuck with me too. And you're right. It's got you right on. I mean, they're people too. Sure. And just like all of us and Russia and China, you know, none of us really hate the Chinese or the Russians or the Venezuelans. It's their governments. It's the people who are in power, who are exercising policies that, you know, are inhumane to a lot of things. So, you know, we don't hate people, and we don't want to have to, you know, do what we do, yeah. But, you know, politics are what they are. You know, people at this level say, you down here, go do this. So that's what
exactly
we're supposed to do.
Yeah. And like a good soldier, you're going to go follow orders, and, yeah. You know, it's just kind of the nature of the beast, and unfortunately, we have it here, they have it there. You know, it's just interesting. As you're talking about the vehicles, the personally owned vehicles from Kuwait being in Iraq and, you know, loaded down with all the personal information and stuff, or personal household goods, it reminded me of a time when I was in Afghanistan. We would see a lot of vehicles driving around with American license plates on them. And I mean, there is no road. I've looked on maps. I've tried to find it. There's no road that gets you from the United States to Afghanistan. So it's not like Americans are just driving around, hey, let's check out what, you know, our buddies are doing over here while they go off to war, you know? So
something's up with my trip advisor. I don't know.
I know, right? Jeez, it's crazy. So we ended up stopping any of the vehicles that we saw with American plates on them, and we took off the license plates, and we kept them. We had a whole wall on our fob that had all these license plates. We must have had 100 of them, all different states, a lot from California, but all across, even some Canadian ones. We were like, screw it, we'll take those too. They don't know the difference. So we took them, and I ended up tabulating all of them and put them in a spreadsheet. And I contacted the California State Police, and I sent them a list of all the license plates and said, hey, the vehicles that were once associated with these, I got to imagine they were probably stolen at some point. You can close out a ton of stolen vehicle cases just by looking at this spreadsheet.
Wow.
And what the response I got back is, yeah, probably 90%+ of those vehicles were reported stolen. And what happens is the cars would get stolen in the U.S. They get driven down to Mexico. They get put on a boat, shipped over to Pakistan, and then they'd sell the cars as is, license plates and everything. But one of those vehicles, I open up the glove box, and it had receipts. It had the registration. It had all these things. I was able to look, and I could see this person. They lived in somewhere in California. They had their address, their name, their phone number, all these things. I was able to look at it. It was like, talk about humanity. Like, this is like tying directly to a specific person, and it was just a strange way to think of it, because before it was just like, oh, we're collecting license plates. This is kind of funny, but now it's like, actually, this was some dude's car that got stolen, and he's probably pissed about it. Here's all his information. I probably could call him and be like, hey, by the way, your car's in Afghanistan right now.
Well, it probably ended up on a container in the port of LA, like within hours.
I know. Like, yeah, exactly. And I mean, they drove those things, and they got pissed at us for taking the license plates, because it was kind of like a, almost like a fashion accessory. Like they thought it, like, this makes our car look cool, like, by having this license plate, you know?
Well, here's the other thing too with that, is if it gives you as a shooter just a half second hesitation, you know?
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. And
wow.
You know, that could be a good or a bad thing, depending on the situation, you know?
That's a great story. Yeah. I couldn't believe when, over in Afghanistan, you just look across, we were at this one fob and climbed the mountain behind it, got up on the tower. We're looking down with optics. Couldn't believe all the Toyota pickups.
Oh God. Yeah.
Hilux.
Yep. So many of those. It's like, we get sometimes, no offense, but we get these intel reports and like, yeah, they're driving a white Toyota. Like, no shit. So is everybody else. You know?
Yeah. Tan Corolla. Oh yeah.
That'll narrow it down. It's like finding the, hot blonde in LA. Like
everywhere you turn.
Yeah. Right. So you transition out of the military. What was that experience like for you? Getting out.
Yeah. After Desert Storm, and after I was disillusioned with the whole James Bond experience, first year in Korea in an armored, in an infantry division, then an armored division for another couple years, then Iraq and Kuwait. I'm like, hey, I've got to do something different, because this intel thing isn't working out. So I was, they cut orders for me to go to the Fort Hood CID office. And so we're going to make you a special investigator. And, after this 6 month OJT program that we're setting up to bring in new agents, we'll send you off to the school and you can be a CID agent. Like, okay, that sounds great. That's fun. I grew up watching cop shows. I always wanted to be a police officer. So I'm going to do that. And it worked out really cool. Because all of a sudden now wearing civilian clothes, got to shed that uniform and kind of drive around. It wasn't doing PT. It's, 5:30 in the morning with the guys. And, I get tied up with, this unit, at CID, and the guy that they put me with was a great dude. Loved him. We got along great. The whole time he couldn't wait to get out.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I can't wait. I wait to get out. I'm going to go be a real cop, or I'm going to go, join the FBI or do something tonight. So, still being young and dumb and just like, trying to soak up as much as I could. I'm like, yeah, okay, great. I'm going to go do that. And so at the end of the period, I had letters for OCS. I had letters for CID, or I could have reenlisted and done whatever I wanted. I could go in another direction. And I decided to get out, and I thought, well, I'm combat vet. Who here has been to Kuwait? No, nobody. Me. I've got all this experience. Oh, I'm going to go be a cop. And so what every good soldier does out of Fort Hood, Texas, is they drive about an hour south down I-35 and end up in Austin. And Austin was, it's like, back then it was the live music capital of the world. It was still weird. It wasn't crowded. It was fantastic. Yeah. So I went down there and I'm like, hey, I'm going to be an Austin police officer. So I went through the whole process and polygraph, physical, psychological exam, all kinds of just assessments and everything. Get down to the very end. My recruiter says, Jeff, your packet is the best we've ever seen. Top secret security clearance, top physical shape. You understand, you know, weapons, and you understand people. You understand the psychology of all this with your intel background. You're going to be great. I get in there. I'm like, okay, great. This sounds great. I walk into a panel interview, and I hadn't had a panel interview since Korea. Sure. When I went to the board to be an E5 and sat down, and I was feeling pretty good about myself, and I was feeling too good about myself. And they said, you're not the kind of person we need. Mm. So that was the moment right there where that transition really hit me in the face, because for the last 4 or 5 years, I had always had a green Army ID card, took that everywhere, used it for everything. I didn't have that anymore. I didn't live on base, but everyone around me was military. You know, you live on a post little town, you know, Copper's Cove or Killeen or Fayetteville, whatever. And everyone around you, you have things in common. You're a group, you're a team. You can trust everybody. You have a connection to everybody. And now I'm in a town where I don't know anybody and I don't have any connection. I don't have that support system. There was no internet. So it wasn't like, hey, I can just, or there wasn't cell phones. I couldn't just text a buddy. I couldn't, you know, read a blog and, you know, what other people were going through, anything like that. It was just all on my own. And that was a really tough period transition. Like, well, what do I do now?
Yeah. And so what got you through that? Like, what, you know, there wasn't any of those things that you just mentioned, the technology that we take for granted today, you can just, you know, you just jump on Google and find your answer in, you know, less than five minutes. You got an answer right now. Back then, I think people forget, back then, that was not the case. We didn't have that option.
No. Well, I needed a job. I had this thing. It was hunger. I needed food. And so I'm driving in my car and I pass a sign, like a yard sign just on the road. Come to work for MCI. And MCI used to be a phone company. Yeah. That was like really big with competing with AT&T. And back in the day, I know I keep going back in the day, but people used to call you at home and say, are you happy with your long distance service?
Yep.
And so MCI was a lifeline for me because it was a team environment. It was, we're all in this together, and it was enthusiastic, and it was, okay, we're going to train you, and then this is your mission, and this is what you have to do. And I was used to that structure. And it was clear, sit there. And the first job I had was inbound, taking phone calls from customers who needed help, or you know, they would call the number they saw on their TV, and it's like, oh yeah, I can get a free month of long distance if I switch to this company. Yeah. And working there was so much fun, and I loved it. And so I had a team back, and it was great. And I did that for 5 years. I got off the phones after a year, and I got promoted. I was a supervisor, so I had 16 people working for me who made phone calls, and that was fantastic. I was back to being the squad leader. I was the E5, and I had on my whole, you know, platoon of privates here, and they were knocking it out, and everyone was making money, and the money was, they used to call it MCI, was money coming in, because it was lucrative, and it was relatively easy, but you needed a high energy level, so I had to pump everybody up. So I did that for a few years and then got promoted again. And then I ended up in the more the management level of things. Someone said that, oh, you got potential, son. I'm like, yeah, okay, great. So I want more money, and got promoted, and I moved to a wholly different section. It was program management, and it was that team environment, that cohesion, that trust your brother element was gone. And we were just starting to have remote working back then. So my boss lived in Maryland. One of my teammates worked next to me in a cube. We had a cube farm of like 50 cubes, just like you could, you know, just like gophers everywhere. One person lived in Arizona. So we were all over the place and we would travel a lot. And that was fun. That taught me a lot about being corporate. But what it came down to, Scott, which really drove me away from it, was I couldn't count on my buddy. I couldn't count on my teammates because they were all only worried about their own projects and the programs that they were working on. And they wanted to look good and they weren't going to help me. I was a new guy. I'd never done anything like that before and got no help, got no support. And I realized it was dog eat dog.
Yeah.
And that's not the environment I came from in the military. It was, hey, you know, we're all in this together. And so after 5 years, I got out. I cashed out right before MCI went bankrupt. So a lot of my friends, my bosses got really screwed because the stock price went from like 77 to 7 cents.
Wow.
And I peaked out. And I had MCI to thank for this. One, that. And two, I won a couple of contests and programs, and they sent me to Puerto Rico. And it was an island off the coast of Puerto Rico. It's a private resort. El Conquistador is this name, something else now. But we had a private island. We had jet skis and everything. It was like a week of congratulations. You did really good. You made a lot of money. Go have some fun. And so there are like 75 people that they send to this thing from all over the world. I think they would have Dara Torres, who was an Olympic swimmer, came 1 year. They have all these, you know, celebrities come and do motivational speeches for you and everything. So it was kind of a big deal. Had to get a tux and everything and all this awards banquet and stuff. And I come back and I'm still working for MCI. And I realize that there's my answer. I don't want this MCI thing anymore. I can't deal with these people. They don't have ethics when it comes to being a team. Sure. And I went back to the Virgin Islands, and that's when I quit and went to the Virgin Islands, just checked out.
So you just picked up and moved. I mean, it was just and honestly, if they didn't have that banquet in Puerto Rico, you probably wouldn't have made that connection in your head that that's where you wanted to be, right?
I wouldn't have known what to do. So I'm sitting on the beach with my buddy, JD Callahan, and we're just trying to sober up. And this dude comes walking down the beach with a spray bottle, with a trigger, and a fan. And he walks up to us and is like, would you like a spritz? I'm like, no, but I'd like your job. And he said, well, that's interesting you say that, because I represent a company that just developed an eco-friendly sunscreen so it doesn't wash off and hurt the coral. So we're looking for sales reps all throughout the Virgin Islands. And I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And he's like, no, I'm serious. Here's my card. And I took his card. And I remember this. His name was Peter Crotty. It was a white card and had like this blue palm tree on it and everything. And I took that back to my desk and I looked at it for weeks. And I finally called him. And I'm like, I'm ready. And I got down there. And we had made friends. Some of my buddies who went down there made friends with the locals. So the little bag people who, when you go there and they take your luggage, we were like, hey, show us where to go hang out. So we ended up hanging out with them when we were down there. So I had that connection. So I would still call back to Puerto Rico. And because I worked for a phone company, I would connect my friend down there to his mom up in Boston. I'm like, oh, hey man, I'll put you through. I put him through. And so we just maintained that connection. So he said, so are you ever coming down here? And I'm like, yeah, I'm coming down. So he hooked me up. He's like, come on down to El Conquistador. You can have a job doing what I'm doing. And so I'm thinking, hey, yeah, $10 an hour on the beach, all these, you know, people in bikini. I'm like, I'm in. And I get down there and I'm waiting for him to bring his boss out. And I'm just kind of sitting in my car in the parking lot and waiting. And then I see like six of these little people run out of the hotel lobby, stand up and line up on the curb. And they're all wearing this, like, you know, tropical shirt, short tan pants, and they all match. And I think, oh, that would be my job, because there was a bus coming. They were going to unload the bus. I'm like, I can do that. But then, Scott, I looked and it freaked me out because it reminded me of military uniforms, standing in formation. And I'm like, no, I'm getting that. I got away from that. So I put the car in drive and left right there. Okay. I didn't even say goodbye. I went right back to the airport and called a friend of mine and said, hey, I'm down in the Virgin Islands and what do I do now? And someone said, go to St. John. So I ended up going to St. John and worked on a dive boat. But here's something good about transitions and the military. I go to this place and it's a job board and I look and there's a job for a dive shop manager. I'm like, hey, I've got management experience and I've always wanted to dive. James Bond was a big diver. I love that stuff. So I'm totally qualified. Had never even dove in my life. So I walk in, this dude, his name is Bob Carney. Bob goes, so, you know, you're in the, he looked at my resume. Oh, so you're in the Army, huh? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, oh, you went Desert Storm, huh? Yeah. Well, I was Navy.
Oh, instantly right there.
Yeah, and I see the Navy flag in behind you. And even though there's a whole Army-Navy rivalry and, you know, different jobs and stuff, we had that instant connection. He could trust me. And he believed in bringing me on. And so he did. He brought me on. A week later, I'm on a dive boat in the Virgin Islands thinking, all right, cashed out MCI. I've got my military connection back. And I'm loving life. Yeah. And that transition there, it paid off after all those years.
It's interesting how that kind of came around and, you know, fortunate timing, I guess, with the MCI. I mean, not for everybody else, but for you to, you know, just happen to line up with, you know, being able to cash out and, you know, come out ahead on all of that and not lose everything, right?
I got lucky.
Yeah. That's a great way to kind of cash out and kind of wash your hands of that and not have to look back and have any regrets at it either, you know? So you did that for a little while. And you ended up coming back working for the military again. Is that right? You ended up going back doing counterintelligence support?
I ended up coming back. My dad had an illness and I needed to be back in the States. And that was just kind of a clean my mind trip. And so I did that for a while, loved it. But I came back and 9/11 happened. So we're talking about at that point. And I was just kind of living the beach life still. And 9/11 happened and it hit me. I'm like, I'm not doing the right thing with my life. Yeah. I've got to get back involved in something. And I considered CID again, and I had a complete packet to join a reserve unit. I was living in Kentucky at the time, in Lexington, super place. And they were going to bring me in, and it was either that or become a cop. And again, that still came around. So I ended up becoming a cop, and that was super for me. But right before... during that transition period is when I got into writing because 9/11 happened and I found myself needing something to do, something positive to contribute. And the only thing I could think of right then was to write a book about all of these new service members who were signing up into the military and they were going off to Afghanistan to go get Osama bin Laden back then. And I wanted to write something to help explain to everyone else still back in the States what these kids went through to get to where they're going. So basic training. And I thought instead of doing just like a chronological, this is what basic training is like, and I'll list it that way. I thought that would be boring. And the writer, David Sedaris, was really popular at the time. And so I thought, well, let's do something funny. Let's do it. Let's make it satirical so that people will find it interesting and want to read it because of that. And at the same time, they'll still learn something and understand and appreciate what all of these 18 to 22 year old kids are doing right now by signing up because recruiting was off the charts after 9/11.
Yeah.
And that was my contribution. So I wrote a book called Yes Drill Sergeant and went on some radio shows back then where you actually had to go to the station and sit down and talk to people. And I was writing other military members and other retirees and people like that just to get some momentum for the book and get some blurbs. I got some great blurbs from people like Jamie Farr, who was Klinger on MASH. Bill Murray from Strites wrote me a letter back and said, oh, yeah, basic training. You thought that was funny, huh? And one of the guys I got a letter back from was a graphic artist. And so I asked him to do my cover for me. So he started working on the cover and he said, you know what, this book should go to my cousin who was in Germany. And his cousin ended up being an Air Force retiree from special police for Air Force. And he worked for U.S. Army Europe headquarters at that point. And he was the anti-terrorism policy guy. So I sent him my book and said, here, my guy says, you know, thought it'd be great. And I had my former commander from Desert Storm write the foreword for me, which is another great thing, because I just asked him for a blurb and he wrote a 6-page foreword. Oh, wow. Like, and he's a 3-star general. And I'm like, I can't believe he had time to do that. But he did. General John Sylvester, super guy, love him to death, wrote me this foreword. And that was in the book that I sent to Germany. It went to this guy named Phil. Phil read the book and he's like, oh, this is great. General Sylvester wrote the foreword. So he took the book, walked into General Sylvester's office, who was the chief of staff of UCOM at the time, United States European Command. And he's like, hey, you know this guy, Jeff Circle? It's just so crazy that once you have that military connection, hang on to it.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's an advantage to it. So, you know, 6 degrees of separation. You know, General Sylvester goes, I wrote the foreword. He was one of my guys in Desert Storm. And so this guy, Phil, he's an American contractor, worked in anti-terrorism, ended up offering me a job.
Okay.
And so that's how I ended up. And I started off going to Italy. He said, hey, I've got one position open in Italy. It's for a mid-level anti-terrorism analyst policy. You can go work for U.S. You work at U.S. Army Europe headquarters or U.S. Army Africa headquarters in Vicenza. I did that for a year. Loved it. Italy was fantastic. But then a higher position came open the next year for the next contract year in Heidelberg. So I did the same thing in Heidelberg.
Okay.
For U.S. Army Europe. So just the 6 degrees were amazing. You just don't give up and still reach out and make those contacts. They'll pay off.
And it's interesting how you just started writing for, you know, looking for some positivity, right? And then that led to this unexpected career change for you, right? You weren't expecting to wind up in Italy or, you know, anywhere over there. Like, it just wound up working out that way. And so I want to talk about the writer's dossier that you've been you know, working with for a little while now. You have a couple authors that are on there that are former guests on this show, which is kind of cool.
Have you had on Steve Stratton Ward Larson?
Yep, Steve Stratton. I think there is Jeff Clark, I think, is another one on there.
Jeff's a great dude. We're tied in together.
Yeah. I want to say there's one or two others, and I can't remember off the top of my head. I don't have the list in front of me right now of everybody who is on there, but regardless, it's pretty cool. Here's another connection. We're coming kind of full circle here with all of this. So tell us a little bit about it and what it is and what the idea was behind it when you set it up and what it is now.
Yeah. So, I retired from contracting. My last gig was the counterintelligence mission in Afghanistan, ran that for a few years. Fantastic. After Kabul fell, got out and had to make another transition. So naturally, drive on. We're going to get into military writing. I always been a writer. I always loved it. I always had these connections going all the way back to, you know, Desert Storm. I was the writer. And so Kabul falls, I had been writing a book and I wanted to finish it. So I did. And then what do? I've got a book. I got to try to sell it. I've got to find an agent and find a publisher and all this stuff. Well, in the meantime, I wrote another book while the first one was being edited. And then I got that done. I'm like, well, what next? So now I find myself in a pool of other writers who have finished books, who have either gone a self-publishing route and are, you know, selling their books and trying to get, you know, traction and attention that way. Or I'm just in a holding pattern and I'm waiting. You know, and that's miserable. Yeah. The query process, the submission process, the wait, the never hearing back. There's stories behind that, lots of them. So in the meantime, I thought, again, I want to give back. I want to do something to help all these other writers who I've kind of started following and I've met, you know, mostly virtually at that point. And one day it just hit me. My Intel background, I want to create a dossier and help use my platform on social media to promote these other writers who I've met in the process who have helped me with my writing. And so I downloaded a graphic. That's the dossier graphic. It's just like a file folder. Mm-hmm. And I put top secret on it and I put their picture and I make it look like a real intelligence, you know, piece of intelligence, like a dossier file and some information about them. And I collect the information from an interview that I do with them. And so, I have this graphic and then I'll shoot them some questions. But again, instead of those traditional boring questions of tell me about your writing process, where do you get your ideas? What inspires you? Where do you write? All those things. Those are all the same questions. I went completely different direction and I decided to make it funny and satirical and be a little off the wall with the questions, but they're each customized based on what I know of the person, what I've learned to from them over the time being together, and their topic of what they're writing. And so it's usually five questions that are totally customized to them, and they send me the answers and I put it on my website, thewritersdossier.com, and I push that out on social media and I just promote them. And it pays off for me because I learn from them and I develop a relationship with them. And it, again, it goes back to that, those military connections that help feed you, mm-hmm. and give you and ground you to a purpose. And we're, again, now I'm in an environment where we're all in this together. The Steve Strattons, all these other people who are working hard to send a message through their books. And so the dossier, yeah. I started it in August of last year. I launched that and then I went to BoucherCon, which is a big writers conference every year. This year it was in San Diego and I walk in, Scott, it was the weirdest thing. Because as a Intel guy, counter Intel guy, I'm not on the headlines. You know, this whole social media thing was new for the first year of, hey, putting all your personal information out there. Yeah. I walk in and I've got a name tag and I see somebody. It was Steve Stratton was standing next to Jack Stewart, Michael Carlson, and a couple other people. And I just held up the name tag. Said Jeff Circle, and Steve came over. There's Jeff Circle. He's with the dossier. And so now all these people, they know me from X and Facebook and Instagram. And that was so wonderful to kind of have a group of people back again. Mm-hmm. And it's exploded since then. I think we've done 60 dossiers. We celebrate our 50th with Tori Eldridge, who writes these ninja books. And I keep it to military thrillers or thrillers in general, but I've expanded it out to crime, mystery, suspense. There are some great writers out there, and a lot of them have the military background, like I was talking about. Like you had Steve on, he's got the Shadow Tier series. Ward's deep fake. Ward Larson, Air Force guy. DCR. So many people I've run into who are doing exactly what I'm doing. With trying to get a book published, but in the meantime, I'm like, hey, let's help you out. Let's promote you. That's what the dossier does.
And that's taking it back to the military. You know, that's that one team mentality. Everyone's in it. You know, we're all trying to achieve the same thing. You know, if one writer sells a copy of their book, it's not taking away from another writer, because at some point, whoever bought that book, they're going to finish it and they're going to be looking for another book to read. Right. And so when all of you people come together and you're helping each other out, because I got to imagine, you help out one writer and that other writer is going to start seeing, you know, the benefits of that in their own, you know, book sales and things like that. And they're going to start helping other people, and they're going to be able to, you know, kind of cross promote different things, especially within very similar genres of books. You know, you finish reading one author's books, you're going to be looking for something else. Well, hey, guess what? There's this other author here who writes something in, you know, the similar space here. So, you know, help each other out. Right. I think that's a great way to go about it. Right.
Yeah. This group is incredible when it comes to, collaboration with each other. And here's a little inside baseball for you, Scott. The other genres are not like it. And what I mean is, like, the thriller, crimes, mystery, and suspense people, I can text everyone I've done dossiers with, and we'll get something going back and forth. That's that genre. The military genre is even tighter. The romance writers, they hate each other. You know, it's like I hear this at conferences. This is the only genre, the thriller genre, mystery, crime, and suspense, where, yeah, the writers are actually friends. They get together. They actually get together. They do this thing called noir at the bar, and they will go and they'll read their work, and there'll be like six or seven of them together. They'll all help each other. And even people who don't have military connections, but they still write good stuff. I've done dossiers on them, and, you know, we've had lots of conversations since then. And, you know, the nice thing is they've actually helped me a little bit. And I'm like, hey, I've got a chapter. Can I send it to you? You know, will you give me your feedback? And I've never gotten a no. Mm-hmm. They'll contact me and they'll say, hey, I've got my book's going into paperback. Can you shoot out it? You know, can you update the dossier, or have a new author photo? You know, so we're constantly in contact. And it's really cool to see everyone's career just kind of come and go, and where they are, and how we all work together. It is so fulfilling.
That's cool. Yeah. And just seeing that progression, right? And even, you know, again, taking it back to the military as an NCO, you see, you know, the junior enlisted who are just coming in, they're fresh, and, you know, maybe they're not quite 100% there, and you see their career start progressing. You know, as you're moving up the ranks, they're moving up the ranks, and it's cool to see, you know, that at some point they become the leaders, and they have their own squad or whatever that they're running, and you get to see that in those people. But you know, it's very similar probably with these books. Is you may get a relatively new author who is getting their stuff out there, and then they write that second book and the third book, and they continue to progress in their career. And it's cool to see them progress and see how, you know, you've played a you know, at least a small part in what it is that they are accomplishing. Right.
And being proud for them, for their accomplishments.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, it, like I said before, their accomplishments don't take anything away from you and your colleagues and the other folks who are writing, you know. Now, you kind of explained your journey, how you got into writing, and that was very fortunate. I think that you had the ability to make those connections. You kept some of those military connections and all that kind of stuff. For other folks out there, other veterans who want to jump into writing, you know, in any genre of book, do you have any advice for them? What can you do to encourage folks to get involved in that?
Yeah, see, I've had so many people say, oh, I want to be a writer, or I've got a book in my head. So many people. And that's why it's so hard to break into, because there are a lot of people who want to break in.
Yeah.
So I'm not really good at writer's advice, I don't think, because my perspective is, who am I?
Okay.
But from what I've learned, I've got some good things to tell you. First thing is, you've got to write. So many people say, I have a book I've been thinking about, and that's as far as it's gotten. Yeah. And that's, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. The motivation has to come in from you. And, you know, with the military background and the drive on attitude, the spirit, you've got to just do it. You've got to put pen to paper, fingers to keyboards, whatever it is, you have to write. And the other thing is, a lot of people will think that, you know, hey, I can write a book, and they haven't really read much because it takes time. And there's a lot going on in our lives. Most of your first time writers, your debut authors, have been at it for 20 years. They started reading Tom Clancy when we were in the military, and they loved it. And they fell in love with books and reading. I have always had books around me my whole life. I would collect them just because I liked them when I was a kid. And I didn't read it. They weren't all, you know, 9-year-old appropriate, but you've got to love books, and you've got to embrace the process. And the process is understand how a book is written. You know, there's a beginning, middle, and end. You have an idea, but then you've got to build that out. You've got to actually do it. And then you've got to read. And not to get ideas to copy, but to understand how a story in a book works. And that's some of the challenge. So what I'd recommend, it's really popular advice, is start off with Stephen King's On Writing, because a lot of people think they can write. I thought I could write when I sat down after Desert Storm. And, I'm going to do this, you know, this funny basic training book. But it was a whole lot different than the writing that I had done in the corporate world. Mm-hmm. So start to write, but get some instructions too, because don't think that you can do what everyone else who's really good at it can do without some kind of practice and without some type of education. And you'll get that if you look at On Writing, and there are other books out there too. Don't get stuck studying the whole time. You've got to write too. And that's where people get bogged down. Then it starts to become, I really can't do this because there is a lot to it. So my advice is this: to top it off, write for 15 minutes a day, or a paragraph a day, or a page a day. Set a goal. And I've heard people do the math. If you write 2,000 words a day, you know, your book will be done in 4 months, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to start somewhere. When people want to get into it, that's the first thing I say. You've got to start. You've got to write. You've got to learn about writing, and you've got to keep writing. And then you'll learn. And then you're going to throw that first book away, probably. Most people do. Or totally rewrite it.
Sure.
Because what we have in our head doesn't work out. But seek out people like me, other people who you can make contacts with. Like, especially if you have a military background. There are a lot of military writers out there. Mm-hmm. And I heard Matthew Quirk wrote The Night Agent. He wrote Inside Threat. He said once, and I met him in San Diego, he said, most of us writers are quiet people sitting on our keyboard by ourselves, solitary, doing our work. We're just happy to hear that someone wants to talk to us. So reach out to, you know, if there's a genre you're interested in, if there's a particular writer or a writer that writes in a topic, contact him. Just DM him on you know, X or Instagram or whatever. Most everyone will respond.
Yeah.
If you throw that line out, if you send 5 messages out, you'll get back 4.
Right. Yeah. And I guess the worst case scenario is they don't get back to you, or they say, no, not interested, whatever. Okay, cool. Move on. Yeah. Find somebody else. You know,
so many good people out there who will respond, and they want to help.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, but your advice, I think, is really great, because, you know, think about, you know, doing something like learning how to play golf. You can watch Tiger Woods play golf all you want. You're not going to be shooting 300-yard drives, just by watching how it's done. You're going to have to get out there and actually do it. And it's like a muscle that has to get practiced. And, watching the videos are great, because it gives you an idea, like, this is the ballpark of where you need to be kind of shooting for, but going out and then translate it into that to actually doing it is a different thing. So that's kind of like reading the books and getting an idea of, okay, how are these characters developed? How is the story, you know, developed, and all these things that go from the beginning, the middle, the end of the book.
How do you start a chapter? How do you end a chapter?
Yeah. And how do you wrap up the book? Like, where you can't just be just put a big the end at the end of the book and be like, that's it. You know, like you kind of have to conclude things too and wrap it up. Unless you're leaving a cliffhanger for the second book that might be coming out. But you know, but still, that takes some planning and writing will help to kind of develop that muscle that you need to develop as you're going along. So, you know, I do like to encourage people though, who might feel like they have a story in them of any genre, that it doesn't matter. You know, you're talking about thriller, mystery, crime, suspense, novels. You know, it could be anything, that you have in you. You know, tell the story. Even nonfiction writers, you know, and maybe even in some cases, especially nonfiction writers, because you may have a story that you took part in. This is a story of something that you happened to you, and it may be just a way for you to share that with the world, where otherwise those stories get lost to history, right? And
Jeff Clark did a nonfiction book on leadership that he learned from all his years in the military.
Yeah.
We've got stuff to share. Let's share it.
Exactly. Yeah. Put them out there. Because, even if you write it in a story, a personal story that happened to you in a fictional way, you know, like you just kind of relate those lessons learned or the experiences that you had and stuff like that. But you don't want to say, hey, this is me and this is what happened to me, whatever, who cares? Like, get it out there and share that story so that other people can experience those things as well. Good, bad, and different doesn't matter. I think those things help us, like we were saying at the beginning of the episode, helps us to understand other humans and understand what those people are going through, what they've experienced in their lives. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, even in suffering, we still have something that we can learn. And you know, you shared some of those stories, you know, at the beginning of this episode. And I think that's just a great way to get that out there in a format that will stand the test of time. It'll survive even long past us. So, you know, I think it's a great way to do it.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Cool. So for the folks who are interested in learning more about the writer's dossier, and what you do, and maybe finding out more about some of the authors who we talked about today, where can people go to find out more about that and get that information?
Yeah. My website is jeffcircle.com, but I've got a special link, thewritersdossier.com, goes straight to the list of everyone who I've interviewed. So it's on the web. I'm bigger on X than I am Instagram, because I can do more with it by promoting more things out with links and things like that. But I'm on Instagram, X, Facebook, Threads, I'm LinkedIn, I'm everywhere. Anywhere I can get the message out about these writers, I send things out. So follow me there. You'll see one. I've been doing about two a week. I did a big holiday blast where I sent out one every day, like the 8 days of Christmas almost. And so I've done something else too with people who haven't gotten books out. There's a page called the Dossier Watch List. So someone who's struggling, a struggling writer who isn't quite there yet, or maybe they have an agent and they're just waiting, or they, wherever they are, if they're not published, I do a thing called the Dossier Watch List. And it's a little different. The graphic is a different color and it's a little less information. It's not a full interview of a dossier, but it's just to get someone's name out there, just to get their image out there, their book title and where they are and their process, and help get traction, followers for them too. They're not quite there yet, but they're getting there. And I see real promise in some of these people on the watch list. So thewritersdossier.com or jeffcircle.com.
Yeah, that's perfect. And for those folks who are in that situation that you just described, where they haven't gotten that traction yet, this is a great way to get that traction even before that first book comes out.
You've got to be rolling. Yeah,
you got to hit hit the ground running with that. You know, you have to have, you know, let people know who is this person even? Why do I care that this person has a book out? What are they, what types of things do they write about? What types of things are they, you know, going to bring to the table when I pick up this book? So that's an interesting way to go about getting these people, you know, up and running right off the bat. Yeah. So pretty cool.
Yeah, give them some exposure, because a lot of people want to write a book and they think that's it, but there's so much more to it. You've got to sell it. You've got to sell yourself. You've got to market yourself. You got to have a network of people who are going to help you. And yeah, the exposure is so important. A lot of people have really hit a wall after they got their first, now what? No, you're just starting at that point.
Yeah. I've said in with the book that I wrote, writing the book was the easiest part. It was the promoting the book afterwards that was difficult.
That's what the dossier is for. We help promote, and it's, I do it just for fun.
Just getting the word out there and letting people know about it. It just, you underestimate how much time and effort and energy and you know, all this stuff that goes into it. It's a lot. So this is definitely an awesome way to go. You know, especially for those writers who are, you know, just dipping their toe in the water and, you know, getting, you know, wanting to get a little bit more exposure. You're probably underestimating the amount of work that it takes. And this is a great service that you're providing to those folks. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And I think it's, you know, just a really cool thing and keeps that community and that camaraderie, like you might've, been missing from getting out when you're getting out from the military, right?
Yeah.
When things go sideways, will you be prepared? Some people are concerned they might have to go for a long time without electricity or even food. That's why I want to introduce you to 4patriots.com. Get preparedness products you can use now and that could save your life later. My favorite is 4patriots' new solar generator, the Patriot Power Generator 2000X. It uses the endless free power of the sun to power lights, your TV, medical equipment, even run your fridge. Plus, it's expandable and comes with a free solar panel. Or pick up one of 4patriots' best-selling survival food kits. Delicious tasting and designed to last for 25 years. They even have kits with real meat, and if the power's out, no worries. Just boil water over a fire, simmer, and serve. You'll enjoy a hot meal and stay safe in a crisis. More smart people than ever are finding 4patriots. Over 2 million customers trust them. You might have even seen them on TV. I had the folks at 4patriots set up a special page for you at 4patriots.com/drive-on so that listeners of this podcast can see this week's discounts and deals before they go away. Go to 4patriots.com/drive-on, but hurry, these deals won't last long. Save more and get peace of mind now by going to 4patriots.com/drive-on. So, well, at this point in the show, I like to end the shows with a little bit of humor. Based on this conversation, I have a feeling this is not going to be lost on you. So, so anyways, this segment is something I call, Is It Service Connected? And it's a funny way to look at some videos of service members doing something stupid, getting injured, you know, doing things that not too seriously injured, that you're not falling out of a helicopter or anything like that, but you know, just doing something that, you know, generally, we can laugh at and, we can take a laugh and then we can also take a look at it and say, you know, would this person qualify for some sort of service connected disability somewhere down the line? And it's always I always do this when there's another veteran on the show on the other end here, and I can't think of a single time where the other veteran wasn't laughing. So I've already looked at some of these videos and I've already laughed. So might as well share the laughter for the folks who are listening to the audio podcast. Sorry, you're not able to watch it unless you go check us out on YouTube or X and check out the videos there where we post them. But if you've gotten this far, you're already committed on the audio, but you can definitely check it out on those platforms anyway. So let me pull up this video for you to take a look at, share it on your end. And this video right now, I'll try to describe it for the audio listeners. Looks like there's a woman, maybe an instructor of some sort, standing behind a soldier who, I don't know, appears to be down on his knees. So I don't know. Let's see what's going to
happen.
She's
standing behind him. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's not really not much else to describe on this. I mean, there's a little background stuff, but it's kind of irrelevant. So let's go ahead and take a look at what's going on with this video. All right. Okay. So she got her. She's choking him out. Looks like she's doing an instructions. On how to put the crook of her arm under his neck, her other hand behind his head, and he seems okay right now. I mean, she's not really putting much pressure on him. He's okay. Now there's a little pressure. And
he's going down.
Oh my God. He's limp now.
There he goes.
Yep. And good night. And good night. He is out. And they're trying to wake him back up.
Outstanding.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he was expecting that. I don't think anyone volunteer to be like the test dummy on this. I don't think anyone's like, oh yeah, I'm going to get choked out by this person who's demonstrating, and I'm going to be,
she was under the chin, but she wasn't catching both carotids. I think she finally got it in, locked it in enough.
She put the pressure she had it was like the pressure on the back of the head. And then push down into it, and that's what got him on both sides there. And
there's nothing like that feeling right before you pass out.
Oh my gosh! So I was in basic training at Fort Benning, and we finished the final ruck march that we did. It was like 12 miles, or I forget how long it was. It was something crazy, stupid like that, right? And so, we get to the end and we're all standing in formation, and I don't know if my knees were locked. I don't know what it was, but I just started seeing the world start to close in.
Yeah.
And then you're standing in formation in basic training. You're not supposed to say a damn thing anyways. Right. I remember just turning to the guy next to me and go, I'm going down. And the next thing I know, I wake up. I'm at the back of the formation, sitting on the ground. Someone had grabbed me and dragged me back. But I went flat on my face. I just went timber right down. It's the feeling of that is just if you haven't experienced it, I don't recommend
it's the time you don't one when you come out of it. You don't know how much time's passed. It's the weirdest feeling when you come out of it too. And I think every basic training unit has that. And we had people pass out. It was they're locked up.
Don't bend your knee. And the thing was, I was not the only one who was sitting behind the formation when I came to. There was two or three of us who were sitting behind the formation, and this is a group of like 50 guys. So it's like, we're at like 5% of the platoon was passing out because
definitely service related. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah. I think, that could have been a service connected, type of thing. And one thing I say with all these people, thank God they have it on video. So if they need evidence, they have it on, they have video evidence. They could submit that, for their claims. So, anyways, Jeff, thank you for taking the time to join me and sharing what you're doing now with all these writers, sharing their stuff and getting it out there to the masses. I really do appreciate you sharing that and sharing your background and everything that you've done along the way. So thank you for taking the time to come on.
You're welcome, Scott. And thank you for what you do with the Drive On podcast, promoting military experiences, making connections. I know it's a labor of love. My work is too, but hey, I look at it now. I know I can text you in a heartbeat and we can get something going on. So I'm always here for you. And I look forward to being on next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.